That's one of my favorite bluesmen, the Leona, Texas-born Albert Collins, with Put the Shoe on the Other Foot. It's from his 1991 album, Iceman. Collins, who came to be known as the master of the Telecaster, that's a reference to the famous Fender brand guitar that he played, was initiated into the blues at an early age by his cousin, the famous Lightnin' Hopkins. Lightnin', okay, no G at the end. After a three-month battle with cancer, Collins died at his home in Las Vegas on November the 24th, 1993. He was 61 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. We're getting off to a little bit of a late start today. We had some technical difficulties earlier, so everybody was running a little late. And what we do is we concede a little bit of time so that the programs affected, immediately affected, can get some kind of a substantial portion of their program done. But we are on to the conclusion of our Free Your Mind week. And this is, for many of you, Free Your Mind Friday. So let's start off. Patricia from New York, you start us off today.
Good afternoon, Eutrice, and good afternoon to the PRN family.
Thank you for that.
I hope all is well. Well, Eutrice, I have no interest in talking about that person who was in Cleveland this week. Not at all. I actually want to talk about Israel and the fact that I see Israel is marching through Africa like they're on a mission. Diplomatic relations were recently established with the Republic of Guinea. A senior official met last week with the president of Chad, and I think of interest is that Chad is currently the chair of the African Union. And talks were recently held with the president of Somalia, who's a member of the Arab League, which has never recognized the state of Israel. They've talked to the president of Ethiopia, of Uganda, of Kenya, or Rwanda. And these leaders have said that they would support Israel to regain observer status at the African Union. It's almost as if this retaking of Africa seems to be the primary mission not only of all countries now, but Israel just really seems to be, you know, marching, creating a path, a swath through Africa that is just unprecedented.
Why do you think this accelerated interest in Africa? What accounts for it, in your view?
Well, I know that I have heard, and I need to find a source to confirm this, but I know that countries like China, countries like Israel, certainly have a need for land. I know China, there's not enough land to sustain their agriculture, and I suspect that may be part of what the issue is for Israel. But clearly there's some economic goals here that I don't think will benefit African countries, might benefit Israel, but I don't think it will benefit Africa.
Oh, no, this is not meant to be of benefit. I mean, they have to talk that way. They have to indicate, of course, this is going to be bilateral. Whenever you hear the word bilateral, immediately you know it's not bilateral at all. It's one direction. But this is also happening at a time when the African Union itself seems to be fractured. And they don't seem to be taking a unified position on this, except as welcoming Israel, you know, with wide open arms. And yet we know that this is about land, the acquisition of land, and with the acquisition of land, the acquisition of all of the resources of the land. Tanzania, for example, it was just discovered that Tanzania has had, and it's been there all along, but it has one of the largest reserves of the gas. I forgot the name of the gas. I'm getting a little ditzy here. But this is going to be a game changer. Tanzania many of the countries that are now in a state of civil war, this is prime time. War is a really great precursor for exploitation. And we have, of course, Israel just chomping at the bit to equate itself with the other so-called leaders of the world in that department. This is one of Netanyahu's major points, to insist that among the leaders of the world, that small country that used to be called Palestine will now take its rightful place in global leadership. And global leadership also means global ownership. So this is how it works.
Well, what disturbs me is, in terms of the historical relationships that Israel has had, why would all of these presidents, they seem to be clamoring over each other. You know, one sees that one country has now established a relationship and they're all flocking. Why?
There's money.
I'm talking about the leadership of the African countries.
Yeah, there's money for them in taking these kinds of retrograde positions. And don't forget, many African leaders came to power with the help of Israel. This is not to be discounted. Israel had a special interest in Africa, in selling weapons, in selling its expertise in war, and in advising people, advising governments on war. Israel has had a long history of assisting with assassinations of people who, quote, need to go, unquote. So Israel has had a long history, not a very nice one, in Africa. And Benjamin Netanyahu is under the gun now, because he's now the target of so many investigations, including for corruption. And he needs to make a move quickly to assert himself. And the best place to do that, certainly he can't get away with this in a European country. The only fertile soil that he could find to plant the seeds of destruction would be in Africa. And we have this occurring at a time when so many of the nations are engaged in civil war, which has created a great deal of fractious relationships. You have people looking for strong men to come. This is the rise of Idi Amin. Israel played the role of installing Idi Amin and so many other African leaders. The trade-off was, of course, they share in the profits of the sale of the resources of the land, the exploitation of the people, and so forth. And they burden these countries with humongous debts having to do with equipping military operations. So this is the foray that Benjamin Netanyahu is making now, and I could only read it as a signal that he is setting himself up for a post leadership life, because I think he's not going to escape the clutches of the investigations that are underway. So he's setting himself up to do very, very well, like the Clintons.
I was just going to say, there seems to be a parallel here with the Clintons.
It is always a parallel. If you're talking crooked stuff, he's talking Clintons. Thanks a lot, Patricia, for getting us started today.
Well, thanks for helping me with an understanding of this. Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Thanks so much. Harvey, how are you?
Good, and how are you, more than wonderful, you trees?
How are you doing? Fine, thanks.
I'm doing great, and I have some interesting news to tell you about. I don't think anybody knows about this yet. I'd like to, again, talk about the fact that we are what we eat, and it's very important to avoid GMO foods, genetically modified organism foods, and spend our money on high-quality organic fruits and vegetables. And I don't know if you know it, but do you know that Bayer Pharmaceuticals of Germany wants, they're known for their medicines, they want to buy Monsanto the largest producer of genetically modified seeds in the world. The implications are absolutely detrimental to us and our families. If you Google the words GMO and obesity, there are many articles about the fact that genetically modified foods are one of the causes of obesity. And Bayer has programs that makes drugs that help in weight loss programs. Also, we know that obesity is one of the main causes of diabetes, and Bayer drugs makes diabetes treatment medicines. Another article said that GMO foods makes rats sterile in three generations. Bayer has infertility programs and makes infertility drugs. If you Google the words GMO and cancer, GMO foods cause they're implicated in causing cancer. Bayer makes and sells cancer treatment drugs, and GMO foods creates inflammation. Inflammation is the harbinger of many diseases like cancer, heart disease, arthritis, atherosclerosis, and many more problems, especially to do with the gut. Bayer Pharmaceuticals makes drugs for those problems. Also, inflammation causes a lot of pain, and Bayer is famous for its drug aspirin, and it also invented heroin. So the merger of Bayer and Monsanto would be, as I said, more than disastrous, and basically they would make us sick and then sell us the medicine. So that's why it's so important to eat fresh organic fruits and vegetables, join community gardens. Go to YouTube and check out recipes for cooking fresh foods and vegetables. Remember, the White House is organic, and the best restaurants in the world serve organic foods because they taste better and they're much better for you. So that's it. You can Google that, the merger of Bayer Pharmaceuticals and Monsanto. They're very close to creating a merger. It's just a matter of price, stock price now. But it would really be something that's bad for everyone in worldwide, I believe, and especially for us and our families.
This is very interesting news indeed. Thanks a lot for bringing this to our attention, Harvey. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Trace. Bye-bye.
We're in New York with Joel. Hi, Joel. You there? Is Joel there? Calling Joel. Okay, I guess he walked away from the phone for a minute, but he should be back shortly. In the meantime, let's talk to Jason from Mount Vernon.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Jason. How are you doing?
Oh, enjoying the weather. It's humid, hot. I'm living in the city here. Of New York, and I'm Mount Vernon. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm hanging in.
I just want to remind everybody. I just want to remind anyone, if I may, your pedigree and your credentials, and that you have a long history of exposing and enlightening people for decades. I recall a migration. Were you mediating, and you were moderating Dr. Henry Clark, I believe Mary...
Mary Lefkowitz.
Yes, and there's two other gentlemen, Black Athena. He wrote the book Black Athena.
Yes, yes.
I believe his name escapes me now. I'm drawing a blank now. But he was Martin Bendel. Bennell. Does that ring
Martin
a bell?
Bernal.
Say it again.
Martin Bernal, B-E-R-N-A-L.
Right. I had a friend of mine who actually witnessed you doing your moderating the debate with Mary Lefkowitz, who wrote a scathing piece in the Republic debunking and misinformation about the revelations and the empirical evidence brought out by Dr. Henry Clark, Dr. John Henry Clark. And also, I recall a debate with Molista Kente Asante about this, debating Mary Lefkowitz. My point is this. Dr. Henry Clark said, and he's a Dr. Henry Clark, people should...
Well, actually, his name is Henrik, H-E-N-R-I-K.
I know, I'm out of breath.
Henrik Clark.
John Henrik Clark, yeah, I'm out of breath, right. That's correct. I didn't pronounce his middle name.
He said that
in the middle of the debate, he said, I debate with my peers. To all others, I teach.
Correct.
And the listening audience needs to know that, although I would request they do know that your pedigree and your credentials goes back far back to those days where these revisionists and these theories of whitewashing so-called African history and the accumulative wealth that's benefiting white society has not trickled down, has not benefited those of color, particularly those who have been placed as Negro, Black, and colored in the United States. This is very unfortunate because we have such an enormous amount of poverty, destitution, mass incarceration because of this. The one person who's wealthy from a wealthy family would get an inheritance of wealth, and that wealth will be transferred over to one generation after another. And, of course, they will build and prosper because of that wealth. The point being is this. The reason why we have such mass incarceration, the reason why we have such much poverty, single-family homes, is a direct result of the stifling, the suffocation of this accumulative wealth that was built before taxed labor right to the days of chattel slavery. And, of course, you know that Dr. Henrik Clark and others, Dr. Ben, have all said, and Dr. Omar and Taj Tariq Bey, the empirical evidence is clear that 500,000 kidnapped Africans from sub-Saharan Africa and West Africa were shipped over to North Africa. The primary amount of Africans, slaves, kidnapped, were sent to other areas, Europe and South Africa. However,
somebody's knocking at your door.
I know. I'm very busy. However, this is the benefit. This is the benefit that has been ignored. This is the benefit that has not been recognized, and the kidnapped Africans interbred with those existing dark tribes of Africa. That's all placed in trust, in a collateralization scheme that has been fast-tracked and hardwired and supercharged.
You're laying this out as if it is all so very sequential and everything, but history always tells us that things develop separately and together. So it's hardly a matter of sequence, because very many things are happening contemporaneously. And one of the things about history is that we also have to look at the downside. And the downside is that in all of these tragedies, Africans played a major role as well in the subjugation of their own people, in the selling of their own people. This is par for the course, because it happens everywhere. You have these kinds of things happening. So a very strong evaluation of how we got here requires us to see every aspect of it. And it's not so pretty. And it's not so one-directional that says, well, this is what the white world did and this is what the black world did. We have one of the special services that Dr. Clark did was to talk about the African slave trade and the role of the Arab world in introducing slavery in Africa. So we have a lot to talk about, but it's important that first we try to get familiar with the history. And there are many scholars who have done it, not enough, certainly, but there is a history there that is credible, and we should get to learn about that. Dr. Clark is a luminary, Dr. Ben, and many others. But the thing is, are people getting themselves familiar with these histories so that when we talk about things in contemporary times, we have to remember that there is a context for them, and more than likely, it's not new. You know, thanks so much, Jason, for your call today.
You're welcome.
Joel is back. Well, how are you?
Hi there, you trees.
How are you doing?
Good to speak to you. A little technical problem there.
It seems to be the issue today. Everybody's having technical problems.
So long as they're resolved, right? I mean, something has to be resolved. I thought with the Democratic Convention coming up, it was strange. I watched a little of the Republican circus last night, just a little of it, my mind began to wander. And I thought of Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail, which I'm sure you're very familiar with. And it just stayed with me. And I should have it in front of me since I want to talk a little bit about that, at least to start. But I don't. So if I may, I just wanted to paraphrase what was in my mind. And I remember in that letter, King saying that he had reached the conclusion that the... Hello?
Yes, we're listening.
Oh, okay. I remember King saying that he had reached the conclusion that the blacks' greatest stumbling block in his or her stride, I'm paraphrasing, toward freedom wasn't the white citizen council of the Ku Klux Klan, but the white moderate, who was more devoted to order than to justice. And my mind immediately went to the Democratic Convention. I wonder why, you know? So I thought what I would do today is just give a little overview of what we've been all talking about for a long time, and that is the corporate liberal who is going to be there in abundance next week. And the way I see it, a corporate liberal is somebody who supports anything progressive, doesn't challenge corporate power. It's really as simple as that. In practice, that doesn't mean that corporate liberals always support things progressive, but they will support progressive policy so long as it doesn't challenge corporate power. And in practice, this means that corporate liberals will fight for progressive identity politics. If it has to do with race or sexual orientation and gender, if it generally doesn't challenge corporate power, they'll be for it. And, you know, major corporations support progressive positions on these issues, too. Corporate liberals march for gay rights. They march for the larger LGBTQ community. We'll hear a lot of that next week. They support feminism. We'll hear about the manifold support of feminism. They support reproductive rights. And they support African-American protests against police brutality up to a point when they become threatening to the establishment, the support disappears. Or when they appear to be threatening to the establishment, the support disappears. And, you know, a lot of the support is all to the good. That's the difference, essentially, between the Republicans and the Democrats. And, you know, in my lifetime, a lot of progress has been made by popular protest of all of these devastating prejudices, you know, that have denied individual rights for years. But when their elected Democrats undermine economic justice and promote imperial wars and refuse to really seriously address climate change, corporate liberals just look the other way. And so when the Sanders group in the platform committee hearings tried to ban fracking, tried to put forth a proposal to oppose GPP, a proposal for a $15 per hour minimum wage, a call for single-payer health care, and a statement of opposition to the Israeli occupation of Palestine, they were all shot down. They were all struck down. So positions sometimes like these have no effect on the corporate liberal. And if there is a centimeter's difference between their platform, which I've read, and the diseased corpus of Republican anarchism, the corporate conscience itself. A corporate liberal, in other words, is one who puts occupation in quotes. A corporate liberal never makes the perfect the enemy of the good.
I want to ask you a question because it occurred to me. I'm surprised, Joel, that you're placing so much emphasis on party platforms. Why? Is it because you have such a great faith that party platforms actually do matter?
Well, I wasn't really thinking very much of the platform, but there is a character that distinguishes, let's say, the corporate liberal from the kind of elite that now runs the Republican Party.
Remember all those wonderful high-minded ideals that were enunciated in the Democratic platform when Barack Obama was running in 2008 and then again in 2012? Whatever happened to those planks that got inserted in that ambitious platform?
Oh, well, of course, they all disappeared. But that's not the point I'm trying to make, you, Therese. I'm not trying to make that point. What I'm saying is it makes no difference so long as reform is better than rollback, to go with reform, even if there are a lot of negatives that are associated with it. That's what distinguishes the corporate liberal from somebody who has a pure conception of politics as a means of procuring justice. And so long as the corporate liberal sits to the left of the, say, let's call him the patrician publican, he has some claim on the progressive mandate, or so he says. But the best way to repel fascism and to realize that which is progressive, in my view, is by joining a real movement that's heading left rather than a party that's moving right. That's all I'm trying to say. And so what we're going to see next week is the Democrats claiming that they are better than the Republicans and then appealing to people like the PRN offices, listenership, to tolerate them because they are better than the Republicans. And even if that means, as it surely has and surely will, for all identity groups, corporate liberal support, a deteriorating quality of life, support them anyway. Because what we've had in the last 8 years, and nobody wants to really talk about this, but it's so obvious, we've had lower incomes, higher unemployment, bigger debts, bullshit jobs, higher infant mortality, higher heart disease, more inequality, less social support, more incarceration, more suicide, more alcoholism, more drug abuse, more debt, and more stress. And of course, that's not important to them, right? What's important to them is that the wages of neoliberalism, which are behind them, are enabled by the logic of the lesser evil, and that's what they're about, and that's what we will see next week.
All right. Well, we'll keep our eyes open. Because we definitely, for me, I just want this whole thing to actually play itself out to the final note, and that is with Bernie Sanders. I'm interested in how he brings this farce to a conclusion. Thanks a lot, Joel, for your call.
Okay.
Leslie, you're next. You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm glad everyone is really enthusiastic today about this subject. Well, my subject is the police murders around the country, and it's not making the news because there's no videotape of Latinos and Indians and white people being shot down by the police. So I like to point out that the slave patrols were organized groups of white men who monitored and enforced discipline upon black slaves in the antebellum southern states. It was their function to police all slaves, especially defiant and runaway slaves. Starting in the 1830s, a chain of riots triggered by race, religious, and labor disputes swept across various cities in northern U.S. cities. When volunteer night patrols were overwhelmed, full-time police officers were employed in Boston, New York City, and Chicago and St. Louis between 1838 and 1885. So, at this time, there are about 18,000 police departments in the country. That's a lot of police. So this police state is going to get bigger and spread further. And all Americans of all stripes are being victimized by it.
Well, I'm going to ask you the question that many people are asking. Is it that we are more aware that it's happening, or is it that much has been made of what is happening now that it's, you know, in election season? These kinds of stories are stoking the fires of, you know, the political races that are being waged here. And maybe all of this is happening because, well, this serves a great purpose, because we get to have that, you know, this the cops versus them versus us, that kind of thing. And we get to once again to drive home the point about why a police state is important, why a police state is not just important but necessary to keep the unchained masses in check.
Well, first, I'd like to ask everyone to go to look on the web, look up slave patrols, and they'll find a ton of material on the police state since the practically beginning of this country. But yes, the police are an arm of the state. They have the right to detain us and kill us for any reason they see fit. I mean, just resisting arrest gets you arrested. That can get you killed. So it's not, it's come out more recently because they're using it to pit groups against each other, so that whites will accuse us, accuse blacks of being too aggressive, and blacks will accuse whites of being too aggressive, and then it pits white against black, brown against white, red against brown, et cetera. So we're fighting amongst ourselves, besides, instead of realizing it's the state that is manipulating all of us to fight amongst ourselves while they're stealing everything.
All right. Now, where do we go with this?
Where do we go with
it? Knowing about it enough, or is there something else that is required? It's important for us to know these things, yes. But what do we do?
Well, we have to inform all Americans, whom we know, whomever we know, whatever color, whatever religion, whatever profession, whether they're homeless or non-homeless, whether employed or unemployed, whether they work for the government or a mom-and-pop business, that we are all being manipulated. People don't see the big picture. They still don't realize that the bankers and their cronies in the government are destroying us slowly and in so many ways that it's unfathomable. But we, the people, have to realize that we're the 99%, and the 1% are taking over the place. And no matter what color you are, when you're a 99%, you're going to be oppressed and taken advantage of. That's why the Europeans migrated to the United States, because they couldn't make a decent living in Europe. They were trying to get away from the 1% over there. Now they're in America, and they're doing the same thing all over again. But people don't realize it, I suppose, because their grandparents didn't tell them why they were leaving Europe. And now it's happening over here, and we have to wake up to the fact that this country, and not just this country, but since we're here, we have to be cognizant of what's going on. This country is being dismantled, and we have to get together and realize that we need a revolution. Hopefully it won't be a violent revolution, but that's unfortunately the way things usually happen. But at least you must know what you're fighting for. You're not fighting because a racist person attacked you. We're all under attack with propaganda and bad food and contaminated water and contaminated air. It's just too much to bear. But if you don't see the big picture, you're going to be caught up in the wrong fight.
Thanks, Leslie, for participating today and sharing your thoughts. I really appreciate
that. Bye-bye.
Anita from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hi, good day. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you. There's so much going on. I mean, if you watch the RNC for the week, if you could possibly watch it, for just 5 minutes. That was enough, I think. I know I'm going to say something that sounds really bad, but I really feel like the ancestors, or the descendants of slaves, they just can't live with the descendants of the masters. And I feel like when you're held captive, what you do is when you get away from your captors, you leave. You don't go back to them. And I feel like that's entrenched in our society, because we won't talk about where we come from, and we won't talk about why we're at this point. And if we're not going to talk about it, it will never get better. We will continue this cycle and continue it and continue it and continue it. I feel very hopeless, very hopeless.
Well, this is a very deep sentiment here. In the sense that it takes a lot to bring a person to the point of hopelessness. You don't see any progress at all. You don't see any indication that people are, in fact, fighting back and are, in fact, taking the responsibility to make or compel a system to change. And in so doing, are also changing themselves and attempting to change their communities. It's an awesome struggle, but you do see indications that people are doing that kind of work. But to have the sense of complete hopelessness, I feel very, very sad to hear you say that.
I feel that way even more so when I speak to my immediate circle of friends and my village that I'm in. I am the oddball out when I talk about Hillary and Trump being almost identical, just going different paths. When I talk about the Democrats say that they want to do green energy, but they really don't, because the number one consumer of fossil fuels is the U.S. military. So it's all entrenched. So even when I talk to them and bring out different examples, like over and over and over again, they still don't see it. They still think everything's okay. And those are the people that will perpetuate that lie that everything is okay.
But you know, this is part of what you have to expect. You know, you can't expect that people who have been very purposely subjected to massive amounts of disinformation and misinformation should in one fell swoop just see the light. People evolve in different ways. You're telling us an interesting story about getting an entirely different picture of where you are, based on your own experiences, based on the things that you have learned, and based on your own observations. So that is the story of your evolution, but you also have to give some room. One of the things we all have to do is to recognize that, one, our journey isn't everybody's journey. And in the process of dealing with people who are not there yet, you just have to be patient. You can't give up hope at all, because at some point you didn't know, and something had to happen for you to begin the process of wanting to know. And it's different for everybody, I'm sure, but I don't want you to feel hopeless about things, because that is the ultimate defeat, isn't it? When you feel that there is no way you can change, meaning you can encourage people to see what is actually happening. First of all, you're not the only one in that kind of a fix. You are not the only one with that kind of a problem. You know, people I know very close to me, they think I am crazy for some of the things. How could you attack Hillary Clinton like you do? Well, I said, because, you know, there are facts. They're out there. Well, why must you always attack her? Because she's getting away with doing wrong things. And no matter what I say, there is such a denial and such an intention to deny that it stuns me, because these are people I regard as being very, very smart, very, you know, they got brains and they use them. They're pretty well up on national and international events and so forth. But there is this thing about Hillary not to be attacked. And you can sense many of my friends, are angry with me right now. But of course, yeah. We do have to evaluate friendships and so on, if that's going to be the case. But what I'm trying to tell you, Anita, is you can't, or you shouldn't, allow yourself to reach a point of hopelessness, because it's one of the few sparks that you will need to just go on with life. You need to have some kind of hope. And I'm not talking that old keep hope alive kind of thing. I'm talking about the hope that you, through your work and through your ability to influence people, that somewhere you're making an impression and it will take hold. But don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. As your life's mission to make people change their minds, it's up to them. But the spectacular story you told us today, and I think that's the phenomenal part, is that you're seeing things more and more clearly. This is great. This is phenomenal. You're seeing things more and more clearly, which means you have successfully immunized yourself. And not many people can do that. Malcolm X did it. Look at the kinds of people who did that kind of work. They invested. They had to go and look things up and read and talk to people and be educated in order to be immunized against a system. You did this, and you're now talking about you're so hopeless. No, you should be joyful that you have begun the process of opening your eyes. And in some way, you probably may not ever know it, but people close to you would be impressed. And they would want to know more. So don't give up hope at all.
Okay.
And do give yourself a small pat on the back. Small. You have to be humble, you know. So keep a nice, humble attitude and understand what you're doing and what you have accomplished. And what you have accomplished is your eyes. You have opened your eyes. And you are seeing things more clearly. That is phenomenal.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you for calling. We have time for a very fast call. Desiree, you are on the air.
Hi. Hi, how are you, Chief?
How are you?
I'm well. I wanted to say in regards to your last caller, I feel the same way sometimes. I feel for her. It can be frustrating when you're trying to evoke something into your peers, into your colleagues, into your friends, and they're just not getting it, and you're walking around like you think you're crazy. Wanted to just speak on really quickly. I was listening to the Breakfast Club the other day. My husband put it on for me. And Dr. Umar Johnson was on there, and he was saying some really great, remarkable things. And I'm not sure if you had, if you've heard of him or you know of him.
Oh, yes, but yes, I do.
He was talking about how we can't, first of all, he said, you know, I don't condone police shootings, or I don't condone the shootings of anybody, and it would be, and what he was saying was, yes,
protesting is good, but where the American people stop, where these movements stop, is at protesting. But what we need to do is we have to go further, and you have to start boycotting. And he mentioned some ideas on some things that we should be boycotting about and boycotting against. But then he also said, you can't find a group of people, or you cannot find the black people to come together and support a movement like this now, because we are all so entrenched in ourselves, right? Like, we work so hard. We got that doctorate degree. We got all these masters. We have our stuff. That's it. It's over. We got the house. We're paying the mortgage. We've earned it. Why are we going to go back? Why are we going to sacrifice all that we've come forward for the idea, for a movement, so that now it's not just me going along. It's not just me with this house, but it's me supporting the idea, supporting my people, supporting my culture. So that was, a kind of memento thing that he brought up. And then also, if this were to happen, if it's just the system is set up, like you've been saying, the system is set up in such a way where we don't, blacks, Hispanics, we don't even have a banking system. We don't have black-owned banks, or if we do, it's a very small amount. And so he was...
But here's the thing. Much of that isn't true. We do have black banks. In fact, since the 70s, I was talking about one bank in particular that was number one on the list of reinvesting in the community, Carver Federal Savings and Loan. An extraordinary story. We do have black banks. You do have black insurance companies. You do have, I just talked yesterday about the box system, or the SUSU system, which is banking. It's simple and it's direct, but totally self-controlled. And yet we don't appreciate these things. We don't understand them as the genius approaches to life that have been formulated for us. But we don't get it because we think the answer is going to come from the outside. The answer is right here. How many, I talked about the president, he commissioned a special inquiry, a special task force to look into police brutality. They came back and they gave him a whole bunch of answers, none of which he's paying attention to.
So it's not that we
do lack answers in some cases, but we have them and we don't want to find them, or we don't put enough effort into finding what is available. And so everything that comes down the pike looks new. It isn't, for the most part. Much of it isn't new. It is new to us, but it isn't new. So that's the interesting conundrum that we have. We have more than enough templates to solve most of our problems. Most of our problems. And yet we don't know this. But we are at the end of our program. And Desiree, I'm so delighted that you were able to get your question and your thoughts in. Thank you all for contributing at such a high level today. I always am so proud about that on Free Your Mind Friday, but this week consistently as well. You can reach me at leadstories, LEID stories, @gmail.com. It's the weekend. Surround yourself with people who bring positive dimension to your life and astutely avoid others who don't. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you on Monday. Bye-bye.